Welcome to the greatest hits of 1904, a date that's very important to this topic of this evening's discussion here on Burning Down the House, in which we lay forth and build up the elements, the passions, the ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment. That's Scott Joplin's ragtime hit, Easy Winner. Now, that's important because we're going to be talking about the Darwin Martin houses, and Frank Lloyd Wright's wonderful string of Easy Winner successes in the early 20th century, the early 1900s. And with us in studio this evening, Oliver Allen, Deborah Allen, and Jacob Allspector as our guest interlocutor representing Vox Populi, the voice of the people. So let's just jump right in. Frank Lloyd Wright, the prairie schoolmaster, finds himself building an incredible amount of work in Buffalo, 1903, 1904. It was a very exciting time in the United States.
It's hard to... now, Buffalo is so much sort of down at the heels now. I hope I'm not offending anybody by saying that, but it is not anywhere near so important in people's awareness as it was once. But it was, after all, incredibly well located at the head of Lake Erie, at the beginning of the start of the Erie Canal, and so an awful lot of money was going through
Buffalo
in the latter part of the 19th century and the first decade of the 20th century, and one of the most important companies in Buffalo was the Larkin Company. And I can't remember what the Larkin Company made.
Soap.
Soap, yes.
Soap. The Larkin Soap Company.
Salt, okay.
Soap.
Soap, okay.
Soap, right.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Kept us all
but,
clean.
The Larkin Company was very successful, and Mr. Larkin said we should have a great headquarters building, and he his first choice was to get Louis Sullivan to design it. But he had this... I can't remember whether he was a vice president or a treasurer or secretary or something of the company, Darwin Martin, who was incredibly smart, and he apparently had introduced some kind of a system, manufacturing system, to the company, which made them even more successful than they had before. So this young guy was very, very successful and very ambitious, and... he said to Mr. Larkin...
This is Darwin Martin, yes, okay.
Yeah, this was Darwin Martin. He was apparently... we were told when we were up there looking at this whole thing a few weeks ago that Darwin Martin was one of the richest young men in the country. He was amazingly successful. And he said to Mr. Larkin, "I'm not sure that Louis Sullivan is your best person." He said, "I've heard about a young guy in Chicago named Frank Lloyd Wright. Let me go out and investigate him." And he went out and found out that Frank Lloyd Wright was indeed a really promising, magnetic figure. And he convinced Mr. Larkin that this was the guy to design their headquarters. And then Wright was designing the Larkin building, Martin asked him if he would build him a house. And he said, Wright said, "Of course. It's, of
course
I'll
to me
build
all the
house.
Time. How about you?" Yeah. Sure. I'm doing a headquarters, and then I end up doing the CFO's house. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it does happen. You deal with a group, and they always invariably is somebody on the group who's looking for a sort of in, and a freebie likes you and
that's
right. Wants to get a little extra.
Part of the whole movement.
You know,
they want to be in. That's right. Well,
as
I understand it, Wright told Mr. Martin that he, the client, should set aside all preconceptions, because what Wright was going to create for him was something that man had never, ever seen in the history of building, architecture, or construction ever theretofore. Yeah. So I'm imagining, not having been to that part of Buffalo, that these it's not just one house, it's several houses forming a compound.
It turned out to be a complex of houses. There was the big house by Martin, which is actually, I think, even bigger than the Roby House in Chicago. In Chicago.
Hyde Park.
Hyde Park, yeah. But it was, there were several other buildings. It was basically a large city block that was empty at the time. And Mr. Martin had told Wright that he had purchased acreage on Delaware Avenue, which was the fine avenue where all the rich people were supposed to live. And he drove Frank Lloyd Wright around the city, and they looked at Delaware Avenue, and they looked at this plot that Martin had bought. And then they were driving around, and they went through this area, which is really quite far from Delaware Avenue. And Wright saw this empty lot, and he said, "This is where you're going to put your house. Not on Delaware Avenue. There's not enough room there. You should put it on here." And he ended up designing three or four buildings on this thing. There was the major house. Then there was a building for Mr. Martin's sister, who was Mrs. Barton. So it's Barton and Martin. It sounds very similar. But anyway, she was Mrs. Barton. And Martin said that he would build that little house first, and that would be a test of how we got along with Frank Lloyd Wright, which was very tricky thing.
That sounds like a very good idea.
But they did get along. They got along famously. They got along so famously that throughout Martin's life, he loaned money to Frank Lloyd Wright.
Which was a constant demand,
always,
as I understand.
Always writing a thing saying, "This is a loan, and you will be paid back as soon as possible." And it was thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that he loaned to Wright. And, of course, Wright never paid back a penny. But we knew about this whole operation because we had friends who were connected with the University of Buffalo, and they were admirers of Frank Lloyd Wright, and they learned about these houses, and they learned that the small house for Mrs. Barton was on the market, and they bought it, and then they proceeded to convince the University of Buffalo that it should express an interest in this big property and in restoring the Mr. Martin's big house, which was in terrible shape at that time.
Uh-huh.
This was in the late 60s. And you would wonder how they would ever do this and how they would raise the money to restore the main house. Well, somehow, sometime around 20 or 25 years ago, there was a movement. A group of people got together in Buffalo. I'm not sure how this actually worked. But they got together and decided they would do this as a great project. And to date, they have spent $40 million restoring the main house and the other houses. Until now, it's almost completed.
Yeah.
And we went and took a tour there, we asked our guide, how long will it be before it's all done?
And
he says, in $7 million.
However long that takes. Well, the houses are not refurnished yet. Is that correct?
They're all, the Barton house, the one that our friends owned, that's okay. That's just about all done, except they have to take out some track lighting that our friends put in. They want to restore everything back to the year 1907.
1907.
The main house was completed, and the Martins moved in.
Well, that's interesting. The official history is that they all went up just like rabbits in 04. But we know as architects that things take a while to really be punch listed and to be moved into. But that era is very interesting to me because there is... architecturally, there is really innovative design content that Wright was experimenting with in Oak Park. Yep. And then again, there in Buffalo with his prairie style. Mm-hmm. Of course, he was not the only prairie school architect, but he was without a doubt, the most successful at self-promotion.
And, of course, he was promoting himself, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but it was worth it.
But I think a key to understanding some of the aspects of these houses and Frank Lloyd Wright and the time is not only an appreciation for ragtime music, but also an understanding of the really, truly revolutionary and progressive politics and thought, not only in the United States, but also in Europe. And I'd like to take a brief break with a little bit from Theodore Roosevelt, our president at that time. Turn it up, Jack.
Instead of instruments to promote the general welfare, they have become the tools of corrupt interests which use them impartially to serve their selfish purposes. Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government, owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. To destroy this invisible government, to dissolve the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmanship of today. Unhampered by tradition, uncorrupted by power, undismayed by the magnitude of the task, the new body offers itself as the instrument of the people to sweep away old abuses to build a new and nobler commonwealth. This declaration is our covenant with the people, and we hereby bind the party and its candidates in this nation to the pledges made herein. With all my heart and soul, with every particle of high purpose that is in me, I pledge you my word to do everything I can to put every particle of courage, of common sense, and of strength that I have at your disposal.
Let TR run. Bring me about halfway up. This is a fabulous speech, and you can find it. This is not radio. This was recorded. This is recorded on an Edison cylinder. And it's in the collection of Sagamore Hill in Long Island.
Wow.
And you can find this on the internet through the Library of Congress. That's this bears re-listening. There are four speeches that are available from TR that you can listen to. The sound quality is not great, but what he's got to say is...
Sounds like LaGuardia or somebody.
Well, but he's talking about a covenant between the people. He's talking about special interest groups having corrupted the government's ability to express the will of the people. This sounds so much like our current president. It is astounding. In 1904, the Pure Food and Act, Pure Food and Drug Act was put into law. Meat inspection became law. The whole progressive movement of we can do better.
Yeah.
Was very much in the zeitgeist. And so these revolutionary ideas that Frank Lloyd Wright had about space are very much all of a piece with the era of TR.
Right.
And
all the muckrakers.
And the muckrakers. Now,
writing them.
In your appreciation of these buildings, Alan Peoples over there, you know, we as architects take these almost as givens. They are works that we very much understand on their own terms. But you, as people who have been looking at different types of buildings all your lives, you grew up in the early 20th century in middle years, and you've known modern architects, and you've lived in modern houses, and then you look at these Wright houses. Do you find them modern, or do you find them some sort of amalgam of some romantic ideas that are pre-modern? What are your feelings about these houses?
The thing that surprised me most about the houses was the darkness of them. I expected them to be light.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
And they were not light. And he had a way of putting a big porch outside a room that totally cut off the light. And I was surprised at that, because I think of Wright in terms of light. And his fondness for a kind of a burrowing. Apparently, at that point, he hadn't really found a way to combine that with light. And you sort of, especially in the Martin House, which is quite big, it has one big living area, which has a library at one end and a dining area at the other, and in the middle is the living area, the sitting area. And the sitting area, so, is far from the side, windows on the side, and behind it there is a great big porch. And it means that that area is very dark. And when you look at pictures from the time, it's filled with cozy furniture. And I think in that way, it seemed rather old-fashioned. But the plans are beautiful. And
well, yeah, but we don't live in plans, you know?
But, you know, even when you see them, they're beautiful. Even when you're in them, they're beautiful.
I think what you were saying about the darkness is really... I was there in the mid-70s when I guess there was... I don't know if there still is this intervening... The property was chopped up, and the little Barton House and the Martin House were separated, and you couldn't tell that they ever were together with the pergola and the conservatory and all those things.
Uh-huh.
But the darkness of it is one thing I really remember, that you go in, and it almost felt to me like it was an escape from the summer sun somehow. There was this sort of shelter, dark cave kind of thing going on.
And that would
on.
Be a very 19th century...
I guess, parasols.
Solution, or that would be comfort in the 19th century sense. If you, for example, here in greater New York City, if you go to the Merchant's House on East 4th Street, and surely you've visited, have you not? Those interiors were intentionally designed to be a refuge from the noise and the heat and the mayhem of the street.
Right. You know, just draw the curtains and all of that stuff.
So in one of these prairie school houses, you don't need to draw the curtains because you have this great eyebrow of of
the overhanging
soffit.
Roofs.
Yes.
The overhangs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the one irony of all of this is that his wife had eye problems, and the time came when she said, "I can't live in this house, it's too dark." And so
she closed it off.
He built her a house by the water. And
not by Frank Lloyd Wright, I assume.
By Frank Lloyd Wright.
Oh, it was?
It was by Frank Lloyd Wright.
Oh, I don't know that one. That's interesting.
That is where apparently he, for the first time, put two pieces of glass together in a corner to make his famous...
released
corner window,
breaking the box.
Right. Breaking the box.
Did you ever take Eisenman's class, Breaking the Box?
It wasn't called that. I mean, he did strange things.
I thought that was the course. Anyway, we would digress. So that was the beginning of... So the solution to that was a new artistic architectural expression.
Yes.
Many years later.
I would love to see that.
I'm not sure when that was. Do you remember, Oliver?
I don't think it was built until sometime in the 1920s. It was long after the first
house available. Has it been published? Do you know? Is there documents on it?
I'm pretty sure.
I'll have to look. What's it called? Is it called the Martin Vacation
House? No, it's called some name like Greystoke or something.
That's right, Greystone, I think.
Something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's Greystone. On the shore of Lake Erie, about
summer house,
20 or 30,
summer
30 miles west
EJ,
of...
EJ, maybe you can Google that and you can let us know over
we'll have
the
to check. I'll have to check that out.
Mic.
That sounds fascinating. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, in terms of the light, the other things he was experimenting with at the time, especially in Robie House, and if you read Rina Banham's really wonderful book, who, by the way, taught at Buffalo for a long time, but if you read his, and where he got to probably appreciate Wright, because he was an Englishman, didn't really know that much firsthand, was the architecture of the well-tempered environment. And he talks about all the built-in lighting and the integration of mechanical and sort of ventilating systems into the attic, sort of passive ventilation. Mm-hmm. And he was doing all these things to develop the Robie House. It wasn't just style. It was dealing with the new technology of central heating, hot water heating, ventilation, the electric light, mm-hmm. and all of those things that were happening around the time. And he was struggling to integrate this into a new type, and it really pushed him. And I think, you know, obviously the indirect lighting was probably not bright enough, and, you know, he you know, probably at that time you didn't have calculation of lumens and those kinds
of things. Not at all.
Things.
It was all just
it was all empirical. Experimental.
And guess what? It's still a lot all empirical, you know.
Yeah, but we can model it now with computers and
we
all
can
that,
model
supposedly.
It, but we don't necessarily do that.
Well,
no.
Yeah,
it's all based on our experience. Yeah. Now, this thread about how dark these houses really are when you experience them interests me because it reinforces my notion that these are very romantic houses. Now, one person's romance is another person's gothic horror, but I'd like to bring it back to Wright's professed love, almost idolatry of Germany and Austria. And what was happening in those places at this time, especially in Vienna, there was the beginning just slightly before the Darwin Martin House and this whole complex was the beginning of the Wiener Werkstätte, the Viennese secessionist work studios. Mm-hmm. And their aesthetic and Wright's aesthetic, especially in the leaded glass windows of the Martin House, the Tree of Life windows that you see everywhere. Metropolitan Museum will sell you a refrigerator magnet with right. that window. Has a real resonance between Wright and Rennie McIntosh and the Wiener Werkstätte. They all had a very similar expressive mode. And if you look at that work, it's really sort of fascinating because
I think they were also all influenced by Orientalism, to what
well,
they
absolutely,
called it at the time.
Absolutely. But then this overlay of romantic, almost emotive expression.
Yeah.
At the same time, and I want to play our next little bit of music.
Oh, cool.
In 1904, Mahler's Fifth Symphony debuted. Let's have some of that music, Jack, please.
Well, you know, the...
And so there's the mood.
Speaking of 19th century or an earlier style, there is a corridor, a kind of breezeway in the Martin House that goes right across the property from the Martin House to a greenhouse. And at the end of the corridor... in fact, at the end of the greenhouse, in the place of honor in the view, there is a statue of the Venus de Milo. And apparently this is... The Winged Victory, sorry.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And apparently this was just what Wright wanted. This is what he insisted on.
Well, I mean, that's the epitome of 19th century appreciation of beauty. How perfect is that?
Yeah. The romantic axis at the end.
Yeah.
It's so much better than having Henry Moore's dotted across the landscape. Not that I have anything against Henry Moore.
Henry Moore in a reflecting pool, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you know, one,
sort of plop art.
Yeah, plop art. Exactly. Thank you.
One way to look at this period, 1904 to 1910 or whatever, is that this, I think there was a general feeling that the entire 19th century had been so conformist and so stultifying and so kind of, you know, dark velvet and everything
Victorian.
Kind of gloomy, and everybody wanted to break free of all of that. And this was, and well, it was well, happening in
well,
in,
not everyone, the, no, but the young, well, but the
young
artists.
People, that's right. They wanted it. So this is why we get Stravinsky and Schoenberg, for example, and why we get Art Nouveau. Mm-hmm. We get all these things which people just and the secession.
Yes, and then the Viennese Secession, and then the Wiener Werkstätte.
Yes.
And then eventually the Bauhaus.
That's right, that's right.
But you wouldn't have the Bauhaus if you hadn't had, rolling it way back, if you had not had the Red House and the Pre-Raphaelites and sure. Morris.
Yeah. And unless you'd had H.H. Richardson.
Well.
Sure, because he was...
That's right.
He was opening the door...
Well, although he was fairly conformist in terms of
yes, he was.
Following,
he was a medievalist, really.
He was, but he was definitely more in bed with the École des Beaux-Arts than Wright would ever even imagine.
That's right.
Wright made it very clear that he had no interest whatsoever in Paris because that was a world totally controlled by the École.
But you can make the case that if H.H. Richardson hadn't done what he'd done, Wright wouldn't have been able to do what he did.
Well, Wright certainly borrowed. If you look at the Hurtley House, which I've
Chicago.
In Oak Park, contemporary with the Darwin Martin House, but with his great Romanesque arch, certainly he owes a big debt to Richardson's work, which was neo-Roman, neo-medieval.
And the Glessner House in Chicago, which Wright was very aware of.
Oh, of course, because it's in his backyard.
Yeah. I think also a figure that I like to teach about is, as a theorist was Viollet-le-Duc.
He's very important.
Who Wright cites as, you know, this is all you need to know about architecture besides the things I tell you to his son. This is him giving advice to his son who was interested in architecture. Said, well, all you need to know is read these books by Viollet-le-Duc and listen to me. I'm paraphrasing.
As a matter of fact, Viollet-le-Duc came up just today in the studio of one of my clients, a young intern architect.
Was he one of my students? Maybe.
I don't think so. He's a graduate. But we were talking about the problems that we have in our profession right now, where some architects are designers and others are very good at technical things, and that there seems to be a great divide between them. And I said, well, you know, look, this is not a new problem. This goes back to Viollet-le-Duc, where the Academy wanted to split the decorators away from the technicians, and Viollet-le-Duc said, absolutely not. Right. Architecture is embracive of all of these things, and if you split it into two different disciplines, then we will have cake decorators and we'll have the engineers.
And he
was right.
And he was the rebel against the Beaux-Arts.
That's right.
And against the Academy and that sort of formalization of rules that led to a whole bunch of theories that some people say created modernism or the theoretical basis for modernism.
But then we have, Wright insisting on being the master architect, being responsible for the integration of the heating, ventilating, of the lighting.
Exactly.
Of
all
how
the technology.
Of how things are actually built. And yet, then the other overlay of this brooding German romanticism, which is very interesting, because we're nearing in the first decade of the 20th century, we're nearing the end of that prairie school period for Wright, leading up to 1909, when he leaves for Europe with all of the plates, all of the plans and renderings of his houses with Mrs. Cheney, the nice. Wife of one of his clients.
Right. Very romantic.
For them. And he goes to Germany.
No, it's a notion. It was very romantic. You run off with, you know.
With a beautiful with lady.
The woman you love.
Yes.
You know? Love conquers all.
And to get his work published in Germany. And now in the...
It reminds me of someone I used to work with. But
well, we'll get back around to that. With the Wasmuth edition, it made yep. Wright's international reputation as yep. this beautiful book, which is as if it. Guys, are you hearing the riotous laughter outside on the through the sound stream here?
Busy, busy night at Roberta's.
Yeah. Okay. They're having way too much fun.
It's a nice day. Everybody's very, very animated.
Sounds like it's wilding going on out there, but I assure you that here at Roberta's that we don't do these things. So, what do you make of it? This possibly brooding nature, and the romantic manipulation of the landscape. Do you think it's the beginning of modernism, or do you think it's the end of 19th-century romanticism? You know, Philip Johnson liked to quip that that Frank Lloyd Wright was the best architect of the 19th century. Yeah.
Well, the manipulation of the landscape, of course, that's an old thing. You know, starting with maybe even before the 18th century in England, but you know, the remaking of the great estates by Capability Brown and everything. He said, "This is a nice piece of property, but I'm going to make it good looking for you." And he would move trees and brooks and
Jake, do you have a groupie out there?
He's a young boy who's fascinated with this. We should invite him in.
Yeah, we should. It might be
ask
young...
him what he thinks of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah, right. Does he like to design things? Bring your Legos.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Oliver. We interrupted you.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that should you keep nature the way it is and glorify nature, or should you manipulate nature, change it and improve it? And a lot of people would say, look, come on, don't try to improve it. You can't improve it. It's much better if it's just natural. But a lot of people say, yeah, it's natural, but it's kind of messy. So why don't we clean it up, you know, and plant some trees in a line to make everything look nicer.
So in the case of a lot that's not on Delaware Avenue, but off the posh track, everything that's there was totally an act of design intervention.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sure. It was all very linear, and these great discs that held plantings.
The urns that came from the harrow discs of the Great Plains.
Well, interestingly
enough, the neighborhood that the Wright house, that the Darwin Martin house is in, was in effect laid out by Central Park guy.
Olmsted. I was
going
to mention him. He did the parkway there too.
The streets all curve and so forth. And actually, it's interesting to walk through that neighborhood because a lot of the houses have kind of little Wrightian touches to them. I think they were built when the Martin House was being built, and so they said, "Hey, this is not so bad." And,
and always happens.
But the funny thing is that, of course, Wright didn't want to play second fiddle to Olmsted. So when he drew his plans of the block of the how this complex of houses that he was designing for Mr. Martin. When he drew the plan, and he would show the neighborhood. He showed it all with straight lines. He didn't.
Oh yeah.
He was not about to show it the way Olmsted showed.
Cause there would be a real frisson there between having these curving romantic, as informed by maybe Camilla Zita or the earlier Viennese theorists about city planning, which is that there should be no straight line vistas because that gives people agoraphobia. And writes relentless insistence on the horizontal plane, which then is translated into a grid, which then of which he is the master, never got over. Even in Broadacre City in the 1940s, where he has these circular towers, he's got the relentless grid happening.
The only thing he got over, if you remember the recent Wright show at the Guggenheim, was, you know, in Baghdad and places where the sort of centripetal composition of round forms, which he used a lot at the end of his life, were kind of, you know, sort of an analog of the ego and psychological ego of himself.
Did he do a plan for Baghdad?
Yeah, big. Greater Baghdad plan.
And then there was like a spiraling
series of circles and things. I mean, he was obsessed by that all his life, but especially at the end of his life, that Greek Orthodox Church and, you know, lots of things were all round, and Guggenheim, of course, but, you know, many things.
Well, you know, you mentioned Orientalism. Yeah. Let's go back to that a little bit. As you experience these houses, did you find them to be pagoda-like or anything indicative of shoji panels? Because, you know, Wright really started with this direction after he experienced, and this is not my own construct, after he experienced the Japanese Pavilion at the Columbian Exposition of 92-93, where he'd never seen anything like that before, and the wide roof with the gentle eaves, and they had at that exhibition a portion reconstructed of the imperial pavilion at Katsura,
right,
with shoji panels and the mats,
right,
and that just totally blew his mind, and that set him off on this path that we now see as being the prairie school or that style. Mm-hmm. Do you see anything oriental in there?
There's oriental glitter in the Martin House. There's a mosaic fireplace, which it no longer exists, but it's quite beautiful. I guess a portion of it exists, but it needs to be restored. And it's a wonderful. I can't remember what the design is, but it's.
But that wouldn't be so terribly different from some of the Lewis Comfort Tiffany mosaics that he did for the Vanderbilts with the unabashedly eclectic stuff that was done in Manhattan in the 1880s. But the notion of space, even though it was dark, did it seem to flow?
You know, this concept
well, it
that
will
the,
someday.
this idea that the,
I think dollars. It did when I visited it. It was very.
This Oliver. Idea that the grid is somehow stultifying is an interesting idea, because I've heard it stated that one of the things that makes New York City livable, at least Manhattan, which is, of course, so densely packed, is that when you look down an avenue, you can look to the end of the earth. In effect, there's no end to it. It doesn't stop. So you get a sense of release there. You're not hemmed in. And of course, if it was all curving, you'd never be able to see the light at the end of the tunnel. The tunnel would be curved.
But I think that you're liking it because you're habituated to it. There are other opinions.
Well, I didn't make this up. I heard it stated.
You're not endorsing this.
I'm not endorsing it. I'm just saying people have stated that.
I've heard it stated. The space of America, of the Midwest, is, you know, coming through over the Hudson. It's sort of like that Saul Steinberg cartoon. And, you know, it just keeps extending across. And in fact, Chicago is very much like that. If
Yes, it is.
Chicago, it's the grid of the Midwest. It's just relentless. All the farms, the whole place is just laid out.
If you go up to the 96th floor of the Hancock
Tower, amazing.
And have a drink there at night.
And then you see the diagonals coming in, too, as well.
Well, but it's almost frightening.
Just keeps going.
This relentless grid that you see.
There was a friend of ours named John Cowenhoven, who was quite an authority on American culture, wrote a lot of things about it, and he said... And he wrote a book called The Beer Can by the Highway. It was a wonderful book because he said, this is the way America is. We throw everything away. We don't go and put the beer can in a trash basket. We are all out. We have to do all out. And he said the essence of America is the unbroken straight line. He says that you have the highways that go on to the horizon. He said you have jazz, which doesn't really stop. You have no coda in jazz. They just keep playing until they're going to stop. And he had several analogies of this kind, and it was a very interesting. He said that's what makes America.
I think I'm thinking of Jefferson's University of Virginia that has the open lawn that faces west.
That's right.
Goes out.
Yeah,
but when you have this physical manifestation of manifest destiny, where you're always pressing on westward, and then you eventually
until the frontier closes,
and now it has closed, then you have a whole new set of problems.
Then you got to get used to it.
Well, you know, after Wright, then we got into modern, and even Wright became a modern architect once he returned in 22, and he picked up something new, and that was the era of the streamlined expression, which means that you could drive in your car or you could ride in a locomotive at 100 miles an hour, which is the epitome of speed. How could anything be faster than 100? As far as the eye can see, until you reach the horizon, and then there is nowhere else to go.
Wasn't that the era Wright did all those Mayan-influenced houses where he was searching for American, something that arose
from the
roots?
That was the next phase.
The ones in Hollywood.
Hollyhock and all of those, La Miniature, those things.
With the sculptural cast concrete blocks.
Right.
Yeah, it was later, like in the Marin County Civic Center in the late 40s, early 50s, when he got into something that was somewhat like modern.
Well, also early, Johnson Wax and Falling Water and that whole sort of, when he really gave up the prairie style, created the Usonian houses, and the Johnson Wax was very modern, it was kind of...
Streamlined
lines that continue, Pyrex tubes and
the Pyrex tube skylights. That was a big hit. They leaked. It didn't work, but it was a nice idea.
Yeah.
So the cult of Frank Lloyd Wright goes on and on and on
forever
and on. I'm sure they still have birthday parties for Mr. Wright, even though he's 50 years in the grave at Taliesin West. But Jake, you have some experience of a cult figure, somewhat. Jake was associate principal at Gwathmey Siegel, and we spoke about Charlie Gwathmey. On this program, upon the occasion of his going on to the next stage in life.
No.
Do you see a Charlie Gwathmey cult emerging?
I don't think so. I think.
Did he run off with a client's wife?
His wife, long wife since the early 70s, Betty Ann was a client's wife originally. They met on the steel houses, which were Bridgehampton houses. And there were two houses that were actually published in Five Architects. There was his parents' house and studio, and there were the Bridgehampton houses and studio. And the Bridgehampton houses were the steel houses, and Betty Ann was married Steel, to Robert
is
Steele.
Is it E-E-L or I-E-H-L?
E-E-L.
E-E-L. Steele.
Yeah.
Huh.
And, yeah.
So
and,
that's just part of the long tradition.
They fell in love and did it. You know, I don't know the personal circumstances, and it's not as romantic as Wright running off and to Europe and all that, but maybe it is. I don't know. It certainly sounded romantic at the memorial where his son, his stepson, Eric Steele, spoke about his mother meeting Gwathmey and falling in love and agonizing over the decision to, you know.
So it was a true love story.
That. It was actually the way Eric described it, and I think the way that it sort of happened. Of course, Charlie didn't have seven wives the way Wright did eventually, I guess. Or well, six or however many he had.
I'm not sure he married all of them.
No,
but
I
that
think
at the end he was being pursued from state to state with an open warrant for arrest under the Mann Act for transporting a minor across state lines for lascivious purposes.
I think it's interesting that Mrs. Cheney, his non-wife, unmarried wife, who was murdered
at Taliesin,
was quite a strong feminist.
How interesting!
And
you think
Wright,
that's what do you think that's what caused her to piss off the servant who axe murdered everybody at Taliesin in Spring Green, Wisconsin?
I suspect the servant was somewhat attracted to her, and this was so against his morals that the only way he knew how to react to it was to accuse her of being a vile, unclean woman. And murder her.
Yeah, for those of you who haven't read the story, Wright was away from the house, and a servant who was religious in a peculiarly extreme way went crazy and set fire to the house and started murdering people trying to escape with an axe. I mean, so the life of the great master, as they call him in Taliesin West still, of Frank Lloyd Wright, was not a happy life with this great talent, and this great need to promote himself also seemed to have attracted a great deal of misery throughout his life. And I can't but have to say that, you know, then you look at these wonderfully productive years at the end of the prairie school life, and his real affection for these brooding works of music and the whole German and Viennese world view, Weltanschauung, it is all of a piece that we've got a protean talent with a brooding side that over time attracted great unhappiness.
Mm-hmm. I think there was great liberation in those days. There were lots of, as you say, social, sexual freedom movements that people were still breaking out of the old ways and still are, I guess, but in those days, there was an especially
Real change, yes.
Yeah, real changes, and then provoked by all the technological change that was happening.
A huge change. And, from in 1904 to 1907, radio, as we know it, did not exist. Marconi did his first experiments in 1903. Mm-hmm. So radio was Morse code. Broadcast radio with voice didn't happen until the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And then the motor car and airplanes and telephone becoming universal.
Yeah, we're living through a fairly, I think, in comparison to that era, fairly benign changes. That era was,
huge. Our changes are incremental, and we would hope qualitative.
Right. I mean, all the modern art movements celebrated that change, and the futurists and, you know, the Dadaists, they all embraced it as a kind of
great belief in progress.
Right. a sort of, you know, the avant-garde, perpetual change and mm-hmm. and all of that. I think
I grew up in that. I grew up believing in progress, and modern architecture was progress.
Me too.
Yeah.
Even though I'm a little younger, but.
Well, I believe that well thought out architecture, regardless of what it looks like, is I don't know if it's progress or if it's just good living. I would like to believe that we've come to a point where we don't need to progress. We need to hold on to things that have value and not throw out the good with the bad just simply for having a neologism, something new as an expression. How about we hold on to the essential good things? And that's something that Heritage Radio Network is all about, because most of the programming is about good food. Where does it come from? Is it clean? Is it healthy?
Right.
Do we know where it came from? Now, in terms of architectural or design thought, in terms of the built environment, I think it's important to raise the level of discourse of where did we get here? Do we know what our sources are? Do we understand the forces behind these works of art? And what can we learn from them? When it comes to Frank Lloyd Wright and his Prairie School period, I'm not sure that many good things came from it. Certainly, a lot of knockoff tract houses post World War II came out of that expression. I grew up in one outside of Chicago, with ribbon windows up near the hip roof.
Yeah. Well, the great American popular house, I would say, of recent decades is the ranch house. Now, the ranch house is right out of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Absolutely.
He invented the ranch house. It's the popularization of the prairie house.
That's right.
And it's got Frank Lloyd Wright would introduce different levels, too, so they took that one, and so the ranch house is always on two different levels.
Well, from Falling Water, then you get the split ranch.
Sure.
Which is the worst sort of derogation and degeneration of a good idea put wrong. Although, I guess the Kaufmans wouldn't have thought that necessarily after a while that Falling Water was a good idea because it was so damp that you couldn't actually live in it. Nice place to have a picnic.
Another wonderful house.
Well, some of these houses are not, they're not buildings. They're pieces of sculpture. I mean, the Falling Water is really a piece of sculpture. You don't necessarily want to live there, but you'd love to look at it.
Well, I don't think of it as a house so much as a pavilion.
You would.
With the running water all the time.
Well, but
sure.
An incredible.
Soothing.
You need to come out to my house in Connecticut. I'm not that close to the river, but I can always hear it. And when the river rises in my backyard, believe me, it's
we have a little place
exciting.
At the beach, and I love hearing the surf. It's very soothing.
Uh-huh.
You know, when it happens.
When it's up, when the surf is up, sure.
Gurgling of water is always considered, I mean, you know, the Alhambra and all of that.
Well, okay.
You know, the water is life, you know?
We live next to a telecom hotel, and the sound is horrendous, and I tell myself it's a waterfall. My mother lived beside a waterfall, and we thought the sound was wonderful, so I just have to reinterpret it.
Now, having made the pilgrimage to Buffalo to see these houses, what did you take away from that experience? Did it reinforce your attitudes about Wright? Learn something?
Well, the most important thing that I took away was the amazing relationship between these two powerful men, Mr. Martin and Mr. Wright, and how they got along. And they were not the kinds of people who would take no for an answer. You know, neither one of them. But they hit it off, and they produced this marvelous collection of buildings. That's one thing I took away, but also Buffalo is a very interesting city. I think it's in trouble now.
For many years.
When we walk down the street in downtown, Yeah. Every other storefront is empty.
But that's not so different than it was in 1982 when I designed the Buffalo Hyatt Regency, when I was working for Peter Sampson and Jordan Cruzan.
Oh, yeah.
I was the senior designer on that. Where the big atrium there with the red steel and the readaptive reuse of the old office building there. Yes.
One thing should be said about Buffalo architecture, and that in that the Louis Sullivan Building in Buffalo is extraordinary. In New York City people are aware of the Condit Building on Bleecker Street. But the Guarantee Building in Buffalo is just better. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
So that was more fun than seeing the Darwin Martin House, although the backstory
is more unexpected.
Fun.
I said, you know, Sullivan is a great master. But then you look at it and you say, how could anybody design a building like this? What does he think he's doing? It's total decoration. The whole building is decoration. It's functional, but it's the amount of decoration that doesn't have any useful purpose except to look good. I mean, where does this whole idea of form follows function? I mean, you know, it seems as if he was denying that throughout his career.
It's a misquote to attribute that to.
And furthermore, it's not Louis Sullivan's quote.
It's not his quote.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh,
it's from another writer earlier in the 19th
Alger.
Century.
Horatio Alger.
I'm glad to hear that.
If you look that up, we can find the provenance of that. I'll post it in my
companion
blog.
But it was not an architect.
It came from some physical fitness enthusiast, I think in the 1860s.
Could be.
Yeah. Well, I think we've come to the end of talking about Darwin Martin and Frank Lloyd Wright. So it's time to say goodbye to Frank Lloyd Wright.
Are you going to sing so long?
No, but someone's going to sing from us. Thank you for joining us. I have failed to mention that TechServe is our sponsor this evening, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer on West 23rd Street in Manhattan. Our program was produced by E.J. Dukoski and engineered by Jack Inslee. Our guests were Oliver Allen, Deborah Allen, and Jake Al Spector, and I am Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Thanks for listening. Talk to you again next time.
Hey, Curtis, before we sign off, origin of the phrase form follows function.
Thank you.
The American sculptor Horatio Greenough, I believe.
Horatio Greenough, yes.
Right,
in what year?
Seems 1896.
Okay, and the house on the lake for Mrs. Martin was Greystoke?
Grey Cliff, I believe.
That's good, because Tarzan was Lord Greystoke. That would be totally wrong. Great clip. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
All right.
Thank you to my guests.